Before the lesson, I've been asked to read from Genesis chapter 22, verses 1 through 19. Now it came about after these things that God tested Abraham. And he said to him, Abraham. And he said, Here I am. He said, Take your son, your only son, whom you love, Isaac, and go to the land of Moriah, and offer him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains which I tell you. So Abraham rose early in the morning and saddled his donkey, and took two of his young men with him and Isaac, his son. And he split wood for the burnt offering and arose and went to the place which God had told him. On the third day, Abraham raised his eyes and saw the place from a distance. Abraham said to his young men, Stay here with the donkey, and I and the lad will go over there and we will worship and return to you. Abraham took the wood for the burnt offering and laid it on Isaac, his son. And he took in his hand the fire and the knife. So the two of them walked on together. Isaac spoke to Abraham, his father, and said, My father. And he said, Here I am, my son. And he said, Behold the fire and the wood, but where is the lamb for the burnt offering? Abraham said, God will provide for himself the lamb for the burnt offering, my son. And the two of them walked together. Then they came to the place which God had told him. Abraham built the altar and arranged the wood and bound his son Isaac and laid him on the altar on top of the wood. Abraham stretched out his hand and took the knife to slay his son. But the angel of the Lord called him from heaven and said, Abraham, Abraham. And he said, Here I am. He said, Do not stretch out your hand against the lad and do nothing to him. For now I know that you fear God, since you have not withheld your son, your only son, from me. Then Abraham raised his eyes and looked, and behold, behind him a ram caught in the thicket by his horns. And Abraham went to the ram and offered him up for a burnt offering in the place of his son. Abraham called the name of that place, The Lord will provide. As it is said this day, the mountain of the Lord will be provided. Then the angel of the Lord called to Abraham a second time from heaven and said, By myself I have sworn, declares the Lord, because you have done this thing and you have not withheld your son, your only son, indeed I will greatly bless you. And I will greatly multiply your seed as the stars of the heavens and as the sand which is on the seashore. And your seed shall possess the gate of heaven, the gate of your enemies. And in your seed all nations of the earth shall be blessed, because you have obeyed my voice. So Abraham returned to his young men, and they arose and went to Beersheba. And Abraham lived in Beersheba.
It is the Bible story that critics love to criticize. Steve Wells, who is author of the Skeptic's Annotated Bible, said this about the story in Genesis 22. He said, Abraham shows his willingness to kill his son for God. Only an evil God would ask a father to do that. Only a bad father would be willing to do it. Pop atheist Richard Dawkins jumps on the bandwagon in his book, The God Delusion, and also comments on the story. He said, A modern moralist cannot help but wonder how a child could ever recover from such psychological trauma. By the standards of modern morality, this disgraceful story is an example simultaneously of child abuse and bullying, and he continues, the first recorded use of the Nuremberg defense. I was only following orders. And he would finally add, what moral lessons could one derive from this appalling story? Of course, when these men deny God, which they do, they rob themselves of any objective moral ground from which to protest God's behavior. But that's a sermon for another day. It is an easy story to criticize. Who isn't a little disturbed by it after all? Verse 2, take your son, your only son whom you love, Isaac, and go to the land of Moriah and offer him there as a burnt offering. Just at every level, that instruction doesn't make sense, does it? After all, it is God in Genesis 9 and verse 6 who prohibits murder and places on it the worst possible punishment. And then later, as he's calling out Judah for the practice of offering their children to pagan gods, in Jeremiah 19 in verse 5, God would say, that never entered my mind. And we're thinking, but what about Genesis 22? And then factor in that this is Isaac. This is Abraham's descendant, Abraham's only descendant, and the one through whom God said, the promise is going to flow. How can you kill the child through whom the descendants are going to come when at this point there are no more descendants? How do you ask a father to offer his beloved son as a sacrifice? It isn't just atheists who object to this story. The truth is, there are people sitting in church buildings this morning holding Bibles who also object to it. Some have even argued that it isn't supposed to be in the Bible, that somehow somebody slipped this in. But clearly this is in conflict with what we know about God, and it certainly should not have been included in an inspired story, they would contend. And the truth is, I think even some of us maybe read the story and we get a little uncomfortable to it, and so we press on to more comfortable sections of the text. We have a habit of doing that, don't we? When we come to these awkward parts of the Bible that are hard for us, we have a habit of observing the Passover, right? So we study all the way through the New Testament, and we get to the end of Revelation, and we get five or six chapters in, and that language starts getting really, really strange. And so some have called it the turn back book of the Bible, because we turn back and go back to Matthew and start through the New Testament again, right? Or you get over to Song of Solomon and you start reading that and you think, well, it can't be about what it seems to be about. And that gets real uncomfortable. So we jump back to Proverbs because that's a little easy for us. And so when we see stories like this, sometimes what we do is just sort of pass by and move on. And when we make that choice, we make a mistake. These stories, I think, require that we pause and look more carefully and ask the tougher questions and dig a little deeper, because along the way there is something that God wants us to know. Brothers and sisters, this story is in the Bible for a reason. Genesis doesn't tell us everything about Abraham. In fact, it only chooses a few episodes about Abraham to include in the book. And so rather than passing by, the question to ask is, why is this here? Why is this episode here? Why would the Holy Spirit choose to include this? And why is it important to the Bible story? And so what I'd like you to ask or to do with me this morning is to resist the temptation to observe the Passover and to pause instead. And to ask, why did God tell Abraham to kill his son? And how could that possibly contribute to the story of the Bible? And what are we to learn from it? So I'd like to give you two answers to that question. And I'll tell you up front, I think the second one is better than the first one, right? I think the first one's important, but the second one is better. So if you're like me and I get finished with the first point and you say, hang with me, because we're going to get a little further, and I think by the time we're done, it will all become clear. So there are two things I'd like to say about this episode of Genesis 22. Starting with this, first of all, I think in Genesis 22, what we have is a story that says something to us about the faith of Abraham. In fact, I think Randy would probably describe this lesson as the low-hanging fruit, right? This is sort of the obvious thing that we see making our way through Genesis as we get to chapter 22. The obvious thing that is here in the text. This is meant to say something about Abraham's growing faith. After all, I think that's been a sub-theme. If you read these early stories about him in Genesis, I think that's been a theme running all the way through here, after all. The interesting thing about Abraham's faith is the way that it runs hot and cold. Have you ever noticed that reading Genesis? I mean, at the beginning of chapter 12, God tells him to pack up and leave his home and hit the road, and I'll tell you where you're going. I got to tell you, that would not work for me, because I totally need to know where we're going in advance, have it marked out on the map, get Google out, make sure I'm taking the best route, all of that, no tolls. I need to know where I'm going. God says to Abraham, you don't get any of that. He says, just get up and go. And what does Abraham do? Hebrews says that he showed great faith. We talked about this last Sunday night, right? Look at Hebrews 11. He showed great faith, and he got up and went. And that's a great story. Abraham was a man of great faith, and that all fits together with what we know about him until we get to the latter part of chapter 12. And then all of a sudden, there's a famine in this place where God sends him. And fearful he's going to die in the famine, which doesn't show a lot of trust in God. Fearful he's going to die in the famine, he heads off toward Egypt. Jeff would tell you, always bad to go to Egypt, right, Jeff? That's right. Goes down to Egypt, and sure enough, he has all kinds of trouble there. He's worried that the people are going to kill him so that they... Evidently, Sarah is a very attractive woman, even well into her old age, a very attractive woman. And he thinks, they're going to kill me to have Sarah. And so they work up this lie, this plot, to cover up their true relationship. And they make a mess down there. By the way, remember that God has promised that through his lineage, a blessing is going to come to every family, and he doesn't have a descendant yet. And so if God's true to his promise, Abraham's not going to be killed by anybody. He's not going to die in a famine. And yet, evidently, as we go through the latter part of Genesis 12, he's having all kinds of struggle with that. And he's not done, because later, when more time passes and they still don't have a descendant, they decide, we need to help God with this. And that's when the whole Hagar thing comes up. They give Abraham Sarah's handmaid, and that makes a big mess too. And so all along, we have this sort of hot and cold faith with Abraham. Sometimes he's very, very faithful to God, and sometimes he's laughing at the notion that a guy as old as him is going to have a child. Until we get to Genesis 22. And God says in verse 2, take your son, your only son whom you love, and go to Moriah and sacrifice him. Look at verse 3. So Abraham rose early in the morning. Are we to assume that's the next day? And saddled his donkey and took two of his young men with him and Isaac his son. And he split the wood for the burnt offering, and he rose, and he went to the place which God had told him. You know what's interesting? It's what's not there. There's no record of Abraham protesting, even questioning. Are you sure this is what you want? Did I understand that direction correctly? I mean, it's like one of those moments where you want to go back and read the manual because you're thinking, this can't be what he wants. None of that. He just packs up and begins to set out and do what God told him to do. And then you get to verse 5. They get to the place, and Abraham said to his young men, stay here with the donkey, and I and the lad will go over there, and we will worship and return to you. So he gets there, and he sets about to do what God told him to do, and he goes so far that he has reached the point that he raises the knife. But there is more here than just his obedience. I want you to look carefully at verse 5. As they leave the two young men behind, he says to them, we will worship and return to you. Do you hear something there? Abraham tells the guys, we're both going, but we are both coming back. Now, maybe you're thinking, I don't know, David, you may be making a little too much of that. But by the time we get to Hebrews, we know there's more going on in Abraham's mind. I'm reminded of what we looked at last Sunday night in Hebrews chapter 11, beginning in verse 17. Notice what's going on in his mind. The Hebrew writer says, by faith, Abraham, when he was tested, offered up Isaac, and he who had received the promises was offering up his only begotten son. There he's emphasized what we've already said. This is the child of promise. How could this be God's plan? So verse 18, it was he to whom it was said, Isaac, in Isaac your descendants shall be called. Verse 19, he considered that God is able to raise people even from the dead, for which he also received him back as a type. Notice that as Abraham is setting out to do this, what does he know? He knows he's coming back with Isaac. How does he know that? Because God said, through Isaac, the blessing is going to flow. Your descendants will come from Isaac, and ultimately the promises will be fulfilled in him. So Abraham is going, saying, I'm not sure how this is going to work out. I just know in the end, Isaac is going to live, and he's coming back with me, even if God has to raise him from the dead. Abraham knew that there was no way God was going to fail. Which begs the question, who is this guy? From the guy that's worried the Egyptians will kill him to have his wife, to the guy who can raise the night. What has happened to Abraham? All you got to do is back up one chapter to figure that out. Because in chapter 21, at the time appointed by God, exactly, when he is more than 100 years old and Sarah's not far behind, Isaac was born. What Abraham learned from that experience is that when God says he's going to do something, he can absolutely be trusted to be faithful to his word. God will do what he said he was going to do. And so now, here at this critical moment, however this shakes out, one thing Abraham knows, Isaac's going to live, even if God has to raise him from the dead. It is a testimony to his great faith. And so, in Genesis 22, one of the things that we see following the birth of Isaac in Genesis 21 is that Abraham's faith has grown and matured, and now we know why his name is in the Faith Hall of Fame in Hebrews chapter 11. That's the first lesson. And when I finish saying that, I have to tell you, there's a part of me that's still deeply dissatisfied with that. And so, if this is an opportunity to display his matured faith, I'm still thinking, but it is an awfully cruel test to bring that out. Perhaps we have not looked deeply enough. Let me remind you of something I said in the beginning. I think sometimes we struggle with stories like these because we isolate them. We look only at Genesis 22, and we forget sometimes that these stories are placed into a bigger story for the purpose of helping advance the bigger story. And when I say that, I'm not just talking about Abraham's story in Genesis. Remember, brothers and sisters, that the Bible is the redemption book, and that from Genesis to Revelation, God is knitting this tapestry of which Genesis 22 is one thread that he has placed in there that somehow is contributing to that broader story. And so it's vital as we take these episodes one by one that we not view them in isolation, but we think of them in the context of the bigger story. And so that's what I would like you to ponder with me this morning. Genesis 22, how does it fit that bigger story? I think that this story about Abraham being called to offer his son Isaac is connected to another son who will be offered as a sacrifice. Maybe you've already begun to pick up on some hints of that. After all, brothers and sisters, these stories about Abraham and Sarah and the birth of Isaac, realize that Jesus is all over those stories. His name is not mentioned, but he is there. He is the reason for the child drama all the way through here. Why is it so vital that Abraham have a child? It's because of Genesis 12 and the promises. I will make you a great nation and give this nation a land. But most important, Genesis 12 and 3, that promise that in Abraham this blessing is going to come to all the families. And as we map out the whole Bible story, we know what that is, right? The blessing is the salvation that will come through Jesus Christ. Isaac is vital because he is that next step. That, can I say it this way? That first next step that ultimately brings us to Jesus Christ. And so, although Jesus' name isn't mentioned here in Genesis, all this drama about the birth of Isaac is all about Jesus. It's knitting together the story. And then we get to Genesis 22. And when you begin looking for it, what you find is this inseparable connection between this scene, this sacrifice, and the one that is to come. Will you think with me about that? Let's just back up a little bit and think about the birth drama. We've already talked about the years and years that Abraham and Sarah were waiting for Isaac to come into the world and the effort that they made to help God do that and all of the drama surrounded by his birth. And that makes us think about the drama that's coming surrounding Jesus' birth, right? How interesting was all of that? A virgin is with child, who bears a child under difficult circumstances. All of that begins to ring familiar to us. And then if you look at verse number 2, remember the language that is used there. When God calls upon Abraham to do this, he says, take your son, your only son, whom you love. Does that language ring familiar? For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten son. And then Abraham is told to go to Moriah to offer Isaac. And some scholars believe that that journey would have taken them very near to the place where this other son was going to be sacrificed. And then ponder this. And I think this is really critical to help put the story together. In both stories, the sons were willing participants in the offering. I don't know that we always appreciate that about Genesis 22. Maybe it's the flannel graph we saw when we were children that displayed Isaac as this little toddler that dad picks up and ties down to the altar. That may be the image we grew up with, folks. I'm not sure that's the image that's portrayed in the text. Let me give you some reasons that I say that to you this morning. First of all, if you look at verse number 6, will you remember that the wood for the offering was placed where? It was placed on Isaac. The heavier load was put on the son. And Abraham, the father, carried the lighter pieces. Why would they do that? Folks, Abraham's old as dirt, okay? He's well into six digits by this point, well over 100 years old. And clearly Isaac has at least matured to the point where dad said, you got to carry this heavy stuff, I can't do it. And so he is given the heavier load. But there's something else here that I think is important. As they walk along, remember in verse 7 that they have this conversation, and it's Isaac who initiates the conversation. Dad, a conversation sons with older fathers have all the time, right? Dad, you forgot something. You kind of left out something important. We've got the wood and the fire, but Dad, we don't have a lamb. We don't have an animal to offer as the sacrifice, right? So at least Isaac is old enough to sort of understand how sacrifices work and all the pieces that were required and to pick up on the fact that they're missing a critical piece of it. He's not a toddler, folks. Maybe a teenager. Maybe older. Certainly big enough that when his father started talking about a sacrifice, he could have restrained old dad. Certainly run off and resisted. The only way this scene works in Genesis 22 is if at some point Isaac becomes a willing participant in this. In John 10 and verse 17, Jesus said, "No one takes it away from me. I give my own life freely." Both sons were willing participants. And going back to the wood, isn't it interesting that in both cases, the sons carry the wood for the sacrifice, in Jesus' case, at least initially. And in both cases, victory is declared in advance. In Genesis 22 and verse 5, remember that Abraham tells his servants, we will worship and we will return. And how many times did Jesus announce in advance to his disciples that the Son of Man would die and be raised on the third day? And then what is surely among the most interesting language in the text is in verse 8, when Isaac asks about the sacrifice, why have we brought all these things but not the critical item? Remember that in verse 8, Abraham says this to him, God will provide for himself the lamb for the burnt offering, my son. God will provide the lamb. Brothers and sisters, that is the Bible story. How God, through the descendants of Abraham, would provide the lamb. In John 1 and verse 29, John the Baptist sees Jesus and he says, behold the Lamb of God, who takes away the sin of the world. There is the Lamb of sacrifice that we've been wondering about since Genesis 22 and verse 8. And then if you factor in the additional information that Hebrews supplies, and now we realize that in the moment, Abraham is thinking about the resurrection of a slain son. Folks, what becomes crystal clear is that there's more here that people don't see. Critics miss the point because they are so consumed with the story in isolation. They don't see how it fits in to the bigger story that the Bible is trying to tell. The son who has been discussed all through this chapter, the son who is to be born to Abraham and Sarah, is pointing to the more important son, the Son of God, who would rescue us from sin. And I think this chapter makes that clear. Critics miss the point because they are consumed with what God has asked Abraham to do. But in reality, realize God did not ask Abraham to kill his son, did he? No, what God did is he intervened and prevented that sacrifice. But it foreshadows a sacrifice that was coming when a son would die because the father did not intervene. Men are appalled by what God asked Abraham to do, forgetting all along that it is exactly what we ask God to do for us. Give your son so we can live. Perhaps the horror of what God did not require of Abraham is designed to help us grasp the magnitude of what God would do for us. There is more to this story. We just don't always see it. The question for me and you is how we should respond to such an amazing gift. I don't know that I can improve on the words of Isaac Watts and that famous hymn he wrote about the cross, when I survey the wondrous cross. We used to sing that before the Lord's Supper all the time. And I think the last line of that hymn captures perfectly how you and I ought to respond to the Son who did die. The hymn says, were the whole realm of nature mine, if I had everything to give, he says, that were a present far too small, it wouldn't be enough. And closes with, love so amazing, so divine, demands my soul, my life, my all. And so if you're ready, give that to the Son, who went to his death because for him the Father did not intervene. Because of the great love with which they loved us. If you're ready to love them back, we want to help you do that. So if you need to respond to them, make your way to the front right now while we stand, while we sing together.